Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 126 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, novelist Ray French speaks with Francis Burns about his roots in Wales and the Irish diaspora, and how other writers' voices can help new writers find their own.
Ray French grew up in South Wales, the son of two Irish parents, and his upbringing in Newport and his second-generation heritage characterise his writing and reading. Ray's first novel, All This Is Mine, features an Irish migrant based on Ray's father. The character is so paranoid about Soviet communism, he excavates escape tunnels under his house. In Ray's second novel, Going Under, another middle-aged father, this one Welsh, also digs down into the soil. He digs his own grave. Ray now teaches writing in Northern England. Teaching at Hull, he wrote a piece called Migration. In it, his dead father does what he never did in real life. He visits Ray in Hull. Can you just describe, Ray, the story of Migration so that someone who hasn't read you would have a sense of the story you tell?
In Migration, I have a dialogue with my father who comes up to Hull, where I teach creative writing. And we go to a nature reserve, which is very close to the Humber Bridge and next to the River Humber. And I thought it was a good setting for the story because it used to be an old industrial site where they actually made clay bricks. And when that industry collapsed, they filled in the abandoned clay pits with water and they turned it into a nature reserve, and some very rare birds, rare species come there. Also, though, in the information centre are some historical records of the kind of people who used to work there when they were making bricks and so on. And, of course, that includes a number of Irish migrants. In so many major industrial towns and ports, there always was an Irish presence. So I imagined him, my father, with me for the day, and I picked the nature reserve to show him round because I knew it would be something that would interest him in a way that the university campus, my office filled with books, just wouldn't. And it was very autobiographical. By that time, my father had been dead a couple of years. And we actually had two funeral services. We had one in Newport, South Wales, where I was born and grew up, where my parents migrated. And that went very nicely. But my father wanted to be cremated. I often think he, in another life, he might have been a Native American. He saw himself as going back to the soil from where he came. And so we had him cremated, and then it was his wish to be buried in Ireland. We took him back there, and I'm afraid to say that the funeral service in Ireland was something that still makes me angry. I requested through my cousin that I would again be able to say a short piece about my father in church, and my cousin said, please, let me speak to the priest. And it was clear this was going to be very difficult. He refused.
The priest
refused, so I was furious. The priest, when he conducted the service, he actually forgot his name at one point.
Your father's name?
He forgot my father's name. He then, in the middle of the funeral service, held a raffle for a local hurling team. We got the distinct impression that because he'd left Ireland, abandoned Ireland, and travelled to Britain, and even when he'd retired, he'd never returned to Ireland. In some way, he wasn't due the full respect that so many others were. I mean, in truth, this was a particular priest, but it left a very sour taste in the throat. I haven't been back to Ireland since. I will go back, but I won't go back to that place where my family are from. Think I've no wish to see the grave. It's not him in there, as far as I'm concerned. So I wanted to give him a proper send-off, to preserve his memory in a way that would feel fitting. And so that's why I wrote Migration. But I wanted to get across how, for so many people, if you lose someone very close to you who's been a major part of your life, they're not really gone. And the way that they live on inside your head, inside your heart, is far more important than a monument, than a grave. I've no need to visit his grave in Ireland. Whenever I want to access him, he's in my head.
In your novels, the two novels, All This Is Mine and Going Under, There is a central character who I presume is based on your father.
In All This Is Mine, yes, because he was so extraordinary that even my Irish relatives would say, "Oh, Jesus, that man's mad." A kind of cartoon Irishman. So in some ways I felt I had to write about him. And I had mixed feelings about that. I mean, for anyone who knew, it was very obviously based on him. But I also knew, and of course it's always possible making excuses for myself, he wouldn't connect it with himself.
Was he alive when you wrote All This Is Mine?
Yes.
Well, that's interesting, because when I read it, my first question to you was going to be, do you write this world and conjure it up and conjure that person up at the heart of it to bring them back to life or to lay ghosts to rest? But he was alive.
He was alive, and when he read it, he laughed his head off and said, "Jesus, that's a mad fella." This, I suppose, ties in with the whole thing about the hidden Irish. I thought, we've had extraordinary characters in Irish novels, we've had stage Irishmen, but has there been anyone like that in a novel published in this country? Very possibly there has, but I hadn't read one. And I thought, there are these extraordinary characters in our midst, and very funny and quite scary at times because of the level of their intensity, the anger that they can project. Surely that would make a character who might interest other people. So, yes, it was very closely based on him. I don't know who you mean in the second novel and Going Under, though.
Well, there's the connection between the two older male characters, fathers, who dig down. They go underground.
A couple of people said, "Oh, you're going underground again."
So tell me about going underground. Talk about that. What does it mean?
Well, I do think it's an obvious metaphor for things like burying your feelings. In fact, there's a line in the novel, I'm sure, where Aidan is remembering conversations with his wife, where she says, "You know your problem, Aidan? You bury things."
What is Aidan doing?
Ah, okay. The premise of the book is that Aidan is a middle-aged man who is an unskilled labourer and has been working in a warehouse. The warehouse then decides to make its employees redundant and relocate to a plant in India where wages will be much cheaper, whose wife died some years before and whose two children have grown up and moved out of the house, is frankly terrified at the prospect of being without a job with so much time on his hands in an empty house. So taking inspiration from a Smith song on The Queen Is Dead called What She Said, which has the wonderful lines, "Why doesn't someone bury me? God knows I'm ready." Aidan hatches a plan to buy a coffin and adapt it so that he can breathe and have his food put down through a funnel and his waste drawn up, and he will stay underground until they give people back their jobs. So it's a quixotic protest, and it carries on from there. It is, I suppose, in one basic way, a story of the little man against the system. And I felt confident that I could portray this as happening because I did read, before I started the novel, the story about a man in Worksop who buried himself in a coffin with special breathing apparatus and a chute where things could come up and down and so on. The only reason he did it was to regain the world record for staying underground for Britain, because some pesky American had claimed it back.
I thought you were going to say he was sort of protesting the mines closing or something.
No, he wanted to be in the Guinness Book of Records. And people from Japan and America were coming to interview him. I mean, the New York Times wanted to interview him. It was absolutely extraordinary. And so Aidan becomes a still centre. People would come to him late at night in the dark when they felt they could do so unobserved and tell him their problems. So in a way, he becomes a kind of father confessor figure. And with that, an immediate interest, he is, if you like, reborn, which was something that felt very important to me. I'm very interested in unobserved lives, in seemingly unobserved lives. A kind of inspiration was that famous Arthur Miller quote from Death of a Salesman, when he said his main character isn't anything special or honourable, but he is a man in trouble, and so attention must be paid. I'm misquoting, it's much more elegant than that, but that's the sense of what Miller says. And I think that was a help, if you like, in keeping me focused on Aidan's plight, and attention must be paid to his plight, as indeed attention must be paid to all our plights. But most of all, there had to be a good story, and once I had the idea of putting him in that coffin and everyone else revolving around him, it would allow me to portray the whole community, which is what I was really interested in doing. Yeah. The setting is obviously based on Newport, my hometown, and in a place like Newport, it's a kind of nowhere place. What's Newport? It's the stop before the train gets to Cardiff. It's a place that's not seen as being really Welsh, and yet it's not English. But what they do have, which would probably go unseen by anyone passing through there or spending a couple of hours in a place like Newport, is the most incredible sense of community and closeness under stress. And that's developed because I think they know damn well no one else is going to look out for them. And I love the way people talk in Newport. You say, where are you from? I'm from the port, I am. The port. It could be anywhere, any port in this country or any other place. And of course, so it's a place full of migrants, a place where people have come from other places. And so there's a kind of strange comradeship that builds up. And my parents absolutely loved Newport. When I say they loved it, what they loved was the fact that people were so friendly, and actually they were so grateful that they came across with these very raw Irish accents straight off the boat. And I think they were probably intimidated, well, they were intimidated by the Irish customs when they left, who they felt treated them very, very badly, deliberately humiliated them because they were leaving the country and abandoning it for the old enemy. Then arriving somewhere like Newport, and very shortly after they were there, according to them, people would knock on their doors and say, are you all right? Do you need anything? And so in quite a significant way, it became their real home.
I had this feeling when I was reading your novels that I wondered if our generation lived in the shadow of a generation to whom things happened, who have great stories. I mean, they lived through the war, they lived through the end of industrialisation, and whether it's almost we've been left to tell the story of our families, our parents' stories. I mean, I don't know if that resonated with you at all.
Very much so. I think, yes, there's a sense of your parents and your family and people you grew up with who are a lot older than you handing on their stories. And I've heard other people, second generation Irish, talking about this, that as a child you felt everyone to some extent was performing. There's a lot of discussion in academic circles over the past few years about identity as performance, the performativity of Irishness. And I felt that you as a child had to come up with a good story as well, and quite possibly that's where myself and a lot of others started becoming a writer. I felt the stories we had to tell weren't that interesting compared to the adult stories, so we'd embellish them, we'd make them up, and of course you'd end up half believing them yourself. And there's a great sense of encouragement amongst Irish people and Welsh people as well to encourage a good storyteller. Go on, and what happened then? Which will give you this great confidence, which is, I suppose, a kind of child rearing, a kind of encouragement for you to express yourself. So there is that sense of not having the strength, perhaps the strength of stories yourself that would hold up a novel, but that you can inherit and pass on those big, full-blooded stories that you've learnt from when you were a child, from when you were younger. I think it's different in short stories. I think short stories are probably my first love. I really love short stories. You can get a glimpse of something. They're much more about compression, whereas a novel is about expansion. I was very interested to hear in an interview Donna Tartt describing herself as a miniaturist. Very interesting, because she's someone who writes such big fat novels. And I thought, yes, that's what I am. I'm a miniaturist. I'll sculpt and scene a short scene with dialogue between two people for a long time until I feel I've really got it right. And then my heart will sink when I realise, because I'm writing a novel, I have to write a bridging section where I bring the characters to another place. I move the plot on. I'm not primarily interested in plot. I'm interested in character and situation. But in order to write a novel, you need a plot. And so I love short stories. That's how I started writing. I continue to write them. But there's no money in it.
when you're teaching writing, what are you teaching when you really feel yourself come alive?
I do think that craft is essential. They have come to university in some ways to learn a craft. But what I think is essential, first of all, is to make them see the possibilities of the imagination. And it feels a strange way to answer this question, but often that's by finding a short story or an extract from a novel that you can show them that they've never come across before, and they suddenly see how you do it. I remember reading an interview with Gabriel García Márquez, Nobel Prize winning writer, who described the effect of first reading Kafka had on him. He read Kafka's Metamorphosis, and the opening line is famously, "One morning when Joseph K. woke, he discovered that he turned into a giant insect." Márquez was amazed. He thought, "I didn't think you were allowed to write like that. It was too simple. It was like a fairy tale. It was like a children's story. With no explanation, no build-up, a man's turned into an insect." For years, he'd been struggling to find his voice, to make it as a writer while he's working as a journalist, and he discovered Kafka, and something clicked. Something I also very keen to stress to the students is to stop attempting to be writerly, which is why I like to show them people who write in the vernacular, Raymond Carver, Roddy Doyle, whoever it might be. I want them to realise that the voice that they've grown up with is the voice of a storyteller. But also the other thing is, I love the Stephen King quote, "If you haven't got time to read, then you haven't got the tools or the time to write." We must always warn about plagiarism, but there's a wonderful article Joseph O'Connor wrote for The Guardian a few years ago when he talked about his obsession with John McGahan. He first discovered John McGahan when he was an adolescent, 12 or 13, I think. And he was so besotted with John McGahan, he bought himself some notebooks and wrote out John McGahan's stories, whole chunks of them, and whole chunks of his novels in longhand. And he said that he felt a kind of, over a number of years, he felt a kind of osmosis taking place. He began to feel the rhythm and span of a typical John McGahan sentence and realised, ah, this is how you do it. And he began, just by the physical movements of his hand, to feel that he was becoming a writer. He freely admits his early efforts were lamentably sub-McGahan. But of course, he learned through this process. You learn by imitation. I remember Patrick McCabe's novel, The Butcher Boy. So my copy dates from 1992. I wasn't the published author then, but I was beginning to think about writing, becoming a writer. I wished to be a writer. And someone recommended this to me, and I was completely knocked out. I just was bowled over. I thought, I don't know how he can make me laugh out loud, and three sentences later, take a sharp intake of breath at the horror of what's happening to poor Francie Brady. And I wondered how he could write something so seemingly simple and yet so powerful in the vernacular Irish. And I had started attempting short stories by then, very abashed. And what I found was, for the next few months, every single thing I wrote sounded like an attempt to sound like Patrick McCabe. And that went on for some time until it drove me crazy. And then I went on to another writer, whether it was Roddy Doyle or perhaps Anne Tyler or Richard Ford, and tried out their style, their long sentences with lots of clauses or whatever it might be. But all those things were very useful practice. And eventually, when people say, you've really discovered your style, you've got your voice, it's lovely to be told that, but of course it's a mixture of your voice and whoever it might be, Patrick McCabe, Anne Tyler's, or your version of Patrick McCabe and Anne Tyler, who you may feel that you've shamelessly imitated, but it won't read like that because you're a different person with a different rhythm and a different background and a different mind. But boy, it helps.
Is there a moment where you feel like you had found your voice then? If you're conscious of your influences, was there a moment where you felt that you knew it was coming from you?
Yes, I was in a writing group at the time. I took an adult education writing class in one of the universities in London, which was very useful. And when that class finished, a number of us who did want to become writers started meeting. And I was writing at the time ironic stories about single people living in London and their triumphs and tragedies. And yeah, they were, I suppose, reasonably witty and perceptive. And then I started to write some stories set in Newport. And I really wanted to write about my Irish family, and that felt too risky, too autobiographical. But I thought, well, I have this other voice available to me, which is the voice of my best friends when I was at school, the friends of my neighbours, which is a South Wales voice, which is described as Wenglish. So I had this voice, this rhythm available to me. And as soon as I wrote a story called The Red Jag, which became the title story, in fact, in my first book, the people in the group said, that's it. You found your voice. And I was gobstruck. I thought, have I? But I think if a group of people unanimously, six or seven people, say, that's it, you found your voice, you should listen. And also I found it easier to write about some of the themes that I feel that are central to me, using a Welsh voice and Welsh characters rather than Irish characters. I was able to tackle Irish characters later on, but I'm very happy moving between Welsh characters and Irish characters. I've got my Irish novel and my Welsh novel. I've got my Welsh short stories, my Irish short stories, my English short stories. It's good to feel that you have several registers and several voices that are yours. I would feel much less comfortable or actually interested in writing about the educated English middle classes of southern England, for example. That might sound like a prejudice. It's not so much that I feel that's been done by so many other writers. What could I possibly add? But not so many writers are tackling the voice of South Wales or the Irish second generation. And I feel there's lots more mileage there. And that's my subject. That's my place. Yeah.
That was Ray French in conversation with Frances Burns. You can find out more about Ray on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 126, which was recorded and produced by Frances Burns. Coming up in episode 127, in the first instalment of an ongoing series, five RLF writers share their all-time favourite book with us and explain why it matters. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.